from the campus of Stanford University.
Now, DNA contains the blueprints for how your cells live, how they grow, how they interact with other cells.
This is the future of everything.
Like a computer program, it allows the cell to perform simple computations to make decisions about when and where things happen.
With your host, Russ Altman.
Today on The Future of Everything, the future of healthcare outcomes and quality. So we usually assume that health interventions made by our healthcare providers are safe and effective. Indeed, drugs, vaccines, medical devices are rigorously evaluated and approved by the US FDA, Food and Drug Administration, who examines the effects and the side effects of all of that stuff to make sure that they work as claimed by the manufacturer. But healthcare is much more than the sum of the drugs and the devices that we are exposed to. Of course, the FDA watches the performance of these products in a narrow sense. Does the product do what it was supposed to do? Are there any new side effects that we need to monitor? But who thinks about the real health outcomes that patients care about? Are they returning to their lives? Are they able to work? Can they be with their family? Can they do the things that they enjoy? Or are they suffering in some way from a disability or ongoing disease? What are the outcomes, the real outcomes of our health system, and are we satisfied with them? The field of health services research, for example, is focused on examining healthcare outcomes and quality of care. A key tool in this research has become big data sets from healthcare, computation, and artificial intelligence. Professor Tina Hernandez-Bussard is a professor of medicine, biomedical data science, surgery, and epidemiology and population health at Stanford University. She uses computation methods to monitor, measure, and predict healthcare outcomes and healthcare quality. Welcome, Tina. Health services research has always used data to draw conclusions. So what's different now with the emergence of big data and these new AI technologies?
Hi, Russ. Thank you for having me on the show. That's a great question because big data has been around for a long time, but it's only recently that we've started using big data to think about health services research, quality of care, et cetera. And I think that's really due to the readily availability of this data to look at more service utilization, to look at more patient-centered information. And so previously, health services research really relied on claims and billing data, where we get a good sense of who's using what services are provided. But it's a very narrow sense, right? We don't know why a procedure was given. We don't necessarily know all the outcomes that are associated with the procedure or the intervention, other than very hard outcomes, death, mortality, 30-day readmissions. So that's why using big data, we now have the opportunity to look beyond those hard outcomes, look beyond lab values, to really look at outcomes that matter to the patient, to get a better idea of what services are best for which patients.
Yes. So you mentioned that the traditional was looking at claims and insurance data. What are the new sources of data that might give you a different, more patient-centered look at what the outcomes actually were?
Right. So we use a lot of electronic healthcare records, but not just the structured data. We dig into the notes. We dig into patient incoming emails. So thinking about what the patient's emailing their physician about using the patient portal. We also use patient generated data. So we're capturing patient data from wearable devices, from Fitbit, from all these other types of information, which can really help us understand, you know, the patient says they're doing fine, yet they're only walking 100 steps a day. You know, and so it gives us a better idea of how well the patient's doing, again, beyond some of these just structured information.
Great. I'd like to jump into some of your recent work because it's just so much fun, more fun to talk about actual results. So you had a great study looking at opioids, pain medications, and especially when the patients are depressed or on antidepressant medications. Can you tell us what was the question you were asking and what did you find in that study? Because I think it's a great illustration of this more patient-centered view that you're describing.
Yeah, so this was a great study, Russ, that we did. And actually, this came about talking with our clinicians. So one thing that's really important in our work is that we have a very diverse group that integrates clinicians and computer scientists and health services researchers and policymakers. So it came to us, you know, when we're looking at managing pain outcomes, we really are treating the average patient. So you get a knee replacement surgery and the department might have an average set of opioids going out, 30 narco per day, for example. However, that doesn't take into account, you know, special characteristics of patients. So in particular, patients who are depressed or patients who might have other issues that might interact with the opioids. So in this study, we particularly looked at patients who were taking the most common antidepressant, the SSRI antidepressant, and taking a prodrug opioid.
So, that includes drugs like Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil. Those are some of the famous ones that are SSRIs. And many, many patients are on these medications.
Very, very common. Yes, very common. And so, Russ, as the SSRI actually blocks cytochrome P450, particularly CYP2D6. That's one of the mechanisms that it works. And so when you're taking an opioid for pain management, the majority of opioids actually are inactive. And so they need to be activated in the liver, specifically by cytochrome P450. And this includes your common opioids such as hydrocodone, codeine, tramadol. So they actually need to be activated once they're ingested. So the question was, you know, if a patient's taking an antidepressant that actually is blocking this enzyme in the liver, yet they're taking an opioid that needs to be activated, you know, what is the effect on the actual patient outcome? And so that was the sort of premise of this study. And right. We looked into actually our evidence in the healthcare system. We used our real world data to look at this effect. And so we said, okay, we have a bunch of patients on this antidepressant. Here's some that are taking, you know, a prodrug opioid versus a non-prodrug opioid, which would be something like morphine, oxycodone, et cetera. And we compared their pain outcomes. And what we found was the patients who were on the antidepressant taking the opioid that needed to be activated actually had worse pain outcomes. And so this is a good example, Russ, where, you know, a lot of times we just treat the average patient based on the clinical trial information that we have, but we know that this data is very selective, right? It's very, there's very strict inclusion, exclusion criteria. And a lot of our patients that we see in front clinicians see in front of them today wouldn't actually meet those criteria. So we don't know the best way to treat them. So this is a great way to look into the data we see just in our everyday clinics to understand some of these outcomes.
So let me ask, just diving a little bit, how did you figure out whether their pain meds were working or not? So yeah, you have this theory that maybe the patients who are on the so-called prodrugs, the ones that need that enzyme, but the antidepressant might be blocking that enzyme. So you say, I have a feeling that those people aren't going to get as much pain relief. Did you call them up? Did you look at the notes? How did you figure that out?
Yeah. So what we looked at was we looked at actually the pain scores that are taken regularly during clinics. So there's a pain score on a scale of 1 to 10. And we looked at their pre-pain score prior to surgery. And then we tried to see what their pain score was at discharge, at 3 weeks, and at 8 weeks after surgery. So there's a normal tissue healing process of about, 3 to 4 weeks. So ideally, we would assume that after 8 weeks, their pain score should be, either equivalent or lower than it was prior to surgery. And so that's how we measured their pain, their pain management. And what we found was that patients who were on this combination actually had worse pain outcomes. So their pain scores either didn't drop to below their preoperative score or they were equivalent.
Yeah. So that is really, I'm glad we talked about that, because that's a great example of these principles you were talking about what really happened to the patient and were we really serving the patient well. I want to go, another area of work that you've done that I really find fascinating is what I would call things that are not about the medical treatments, but that are part of the healthcare system that also impact outcomes. And just to pick from your recent work, you looked at reimbursement as a factor in whether outcomes reimbursement and also other non-medical factors and how they can impact the experience of the healthcare system. So can you talk a little bit about that general approach? Because it's not about whether the drug works or whether the device works. It's really about whether the system worked. And so tell us how you approach those types, and maybe even tell us a story or two about those kinds of studies that you've done.
Yeah. And so we've looked a lot at reimbursement drug, because, this is a really important factor of the system, right? And so not that we are motivated by reimbursement, but reimbursement drives the healthcare system, right?
Of course, of course.
And so a lot of times, the patient is not aware of these different incentives that might be in place. And so we looked at reimbursement rates across a variety of factors and looked at how this might affect different types of treatments that are offered, different types of outcomes that the patient might have, and also the patient's ability to even cover those expenses, right? So depending on the patient's insurance coverage, right, there might be differences in what they can be offered or cannot be offered. Right. And so again, this goes back to the evidence that we have. And in a lot of our trials, you know, reimbursement is not a factor here, right? You give the treatment that you're testing.
Right. And everybody so gets it. It's kind of part of the deal. We're going to give you this drug for free in exchange for your participation in a trial. But once we get out into the real world, that's not what the deal is.
Exactly. And so this is something we've just recently published on this, Russ, in we're looking at clinical trials for prostate cancer resistant cancer. And we looked at clinical trials and we were looking at different types of treatment for metastatic resistant prostate cancer. And what we found was that, you know, certain patient populations did not do as well, did not receive the same treatment. And so the question came down to, is it that they weren't offered the treatment or did they not want the treatment? They don't trust the healthcare system. They don't. And so it's a really complex problem. But what we're starting to do is we're starting to dive into these issues to see, you know, if we look only in these specific populations and look at those who get treatment versus those who don't, can we compare it to what we see in clinical trials? How much is reimbursement or cost of treatment playing a role into this? And so it's a really interesting question.
So when you say reimbursement, just to dive a little bit more, there's two issues that I can imagine. There's the amount of money that the healthcare system makes for doing a surgery or a procedure. Sure. And there's also the cost to the patient, like your copay is going to be $1,000 or $5. And that could make a big difference about, and are you looking at both those factors or is it predominantly one or the other?
Yeah, we're looking at both those factors. And that's a good point, right? So, and this also goes to the way when we think about administrative claims data that we're talking about earlier, right? You're going to code, you're going to put things in there that are really going to drive the DRGs and the reimbursement rates, right?
Right.
And so that's another issue when using these claims data, you know, is what's getting recorded in there. And so that is, yeah, we look at both of those factors because they're both really important.
And within this same area, I know you also did a very interesting study on carpal tunnel syndrome. And I guess there was a movement to go to do the procedures in the hospital versus outside. And you made some interesting observations about that transition. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what motivated
right.
it?
Yeah. So we work very closely with one of our surgeons who does carpal tunnel syndrome, and it's a very quick procedure, right? You go in, you snip a nerve, very, very easy. But one of the things, and again, this shows how we work so closely with our clinicians, you know, the time, the prep time to do this in the inpatient setting, the PEP, the nurses, the staffing, et cetera. And what they found was, you know, they can do it in an outpatient setting so much quicker, so much easier, so much cheaper. Mm-hmm. Outcomes are the same, et cetera. But, you know, there's just this drive that they want, you know, systems want it done in the inpatient setting. So it's interesting when you can prove that you can do a surgery in either setting with comparable outcomes, reduced costs, same level of safety, it's still, the healthcare system still is reluctant to move in that direction. You know, it's that 18 year gap between
right.
evidence and practice.
Very
change.
Interesting. And so this might feed back into those other issues about the economic models and the sustainability.
Yeah.
And we can do it just as well and cheaper, but we have a hospital to run and you're asking us to say goodbye to some revenue.
Exactly.
Very
exactly.
tricky.
Yeah.
So again, this is like a candy land for me, but you also wrote, this is going in a totally different direction. You wrote a paper about firearms, guns, and you made some observations.
Yes.
And so I love that because that is definitely not something that the FDA thinks about very much, but it is a real thing in our society. And unfortunately we hear about it all the time. So tell me about, how did firearms get on your radar where you're normally thinking about carpal tunnel syndrome and prostate
right.
cancer?
Right. Well, so this was a funny story, Russ, because, you know, we've done a lot of work on opioids, right? And one of the things we looked at in opioids is we're looking at policy changes and how policy changes affect opioid prescribing, how it affected patients' accessibility to opioids, et cetera. And so one of my postdocs was like, I wonder if it's the same for firearms. You know, can we look at this data? So it's under the same premise of, you know, there's been all of these mass shootings in the US, there's been policies coming, changing. Has it made an effect on the availability of firearms that we can measure? And so it's the same methodology, just a different topic. Yeah. And so it was really interesting, you know, and we found, you know, there's a lot of noise, just like there's a lot of noise in our healthcare data. And so it's really hard to identify when you see these increases in mass shootings, you know, is it statistically significant? And it was hard to find that value there, but it was the same premise of, you know, how can we look at it? It's really what policies work. How do we make them work? And how do we make them change behavior, both from, you know, if you're in the healthcare system, the clinician's behavior, the patient's behavior, prescribing patterns, utilization patterns, et cetera. So really trying to understand how we can drive policy to significantly impact, you know, and get the desired changes we're looking at.
Great. That was a real kind of, whoa, look at that. But you have this tool set and the tool set can be applied broadly. Speaking of the tool set, I know that you've had a little bit of a focus in cardiovascular medicine and especially looking at what people call real world data, which is it's a funny phrase. So could you kind of define for me what real world data is and why it's exciting? And we'll finish out this segment and then we'll probably dive in a little bit more in a couple of minutes. But I thought all data was real world, but it sounds like there might be less real.
There's less real data. Real world data is what we generate through routine clinical care, right? This is non-protocol care. This is non-clinical trial care, non-randomized patients. This is just real world data is what we see every day in the clinic, in the hospital, in the outpatient setting. Okay. It is, and a good example is you have a patient, they're scheduled to come back for treatment in 3 weeks. The patient's on vacation. I'm going to come back in 5 weeks. You know, the patient got a cold. I'm going to come back in 6 months. You know, so we can't control the protocol treatment schedules. We can't control all of these other things because it's real world, right? Patients have lives to live. We hope they're not living their lives based on our schedule, right?
I see.
And so that's the difference with real world data.
So it's the real world then refers to the fact that there's also like this FDA world of controlled data. So it's not that it's unreal data and real data. It's real world versus very controlled world data. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's unfortunate, but most of the healthcare in the world is going to be real world, subject to all of these considerations. So what's the value to you? I mean, somebody could say, well, that's not going to be, it's going to be impossible to analyze because it has all of these random events that can obfuscate the signal.
Right. So there's a couple advantages to this. One is just the massive data, right? So we're looking at clinical trials who might have 500, 1,000 people per trial. We're looking in our real world evidence. We have 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people, right? So there is noise, but just the volume of data we have. In addition, what we have is because of the volume of data, we can look at subpopulations, right? We can look at what does this treatment look like in African Americans? What does this treatment look like in patients with mental health illnesses? What is this? You know, we can start subdividing the population so we get a better idea related to generalizability, effectiveness, cultural differences, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where the real value comes in, right? You can have the best treatment in the world, but if, you know, everyone is afraid to use it, if it makes people sick, if people can't tolerate it, you're going to have a less utilization, less uptake, et cetera. And so looking at real world data, we know exactly what is being prescribed, what's being used. We know the side effects, we know minor side effects, which can often, you know, drive the actual utilization. We're doing a great study in cardiovascular research, looking at reasons for statin non-adherence, right? And so why patients are not taking their statins. And
these are cholesterol medications for lowering your cholesterol.
Exactly. And a lot of it is patient trust in the system. You know, a lot of it is clinicians being unaware of the guideline recommendations, which is very surprising. But a lot of it is trust and side effects of the medication and things like that. So having a better understanding of that can help us develop better drugs, can help us develop better policies, can help the clinicians better treat their patients to identify the right type of medicine for the right patient.
This is the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman, and we'll have more with Professor Tina Hernandez-Bussard talking about real-world data, a little bit about AI and issues of trust next on SiriusXM.
The future of everything with Russ Altman.
I'm an enthusiast. I'm not a journalist.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Professor Tina Hernandez-Bussard, and we're talking about health services research, outcomes, healthcare quality. And we were just starting in the last segment to talk about your studies of real-world data. You defined it for us, and you started to tell us some of the things you've been observing, especially in the area of cardiovascular disease. And I know you looked at some work with heart attacks and the different kinds of data. So can you tell us about that work and what you found?
Yeah, so let me give you the sort of the motivation for this study. And the motivation for this study was in 2016, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, said we have to start using real world data to understand clinical assertions, right? And so we really wanted to look at our real world data to see how well we can identify those assertions. So And in our real world data, Russ, we have regular structured data, which are, you know, disease codes, procedure codes, medications, et cetera. But then we have unstructured data, which is what the clinician writes, you know, his thoughts, his premises about the patient. And so we look at these two sources of data. And the other thing I should say is probably 80% of EHRs is unstructured data. Notes,
so it's a
progress
huge,
reports.
It's a huge amount of the record.
It is. And so we looked, you know, if you're looking at a drug or heart attack, or you want to select a patient cohort to study one of these drugs, and let's say you want to look at patients who have never had a heart attack. Okay, so you're going to go through and you're going to look at the structured data for anybody who has an ICD-9 code of a heart attack. So that's easy. But what we find, Russ, and what we found in some of our studies is that when patients have a mild heart attack, so maybe it's just a very minor heart attack, it's only seen in one visit, that's much less likely to be recorded in the structured data.
Wow.
And more likely to be written in the notes.
That
right?
seems so like a big deal.
Right. So depending how strict you want your criteria, this is really important, right? Same for asthma. Asthma is another good example. Mild asthma, you know, sometimes it'll make it as an ICD-9 code, or ICD-10 code. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes it might just be written in the note. Patient has, mild symptoms of asthma yeah. occasionally.
So just to be clear, this is not that the physician is missing the diagnosis. It's that they didn't think for whatever reason that it was worth coding in one of those structured codes that you were talking about. They just mentioned it almost in passing in the note. And yet this is incredibly important information for a patient to know that they've had a mild heart attack, because mild heart attacks often precede major heart attacks.
Exactly. And Russ, one of the settings might be, they might be coming in for something else, right? They might be coming in to see a doctor for, maybe a dermatology appointment or something like that. And this comes up and they, you know, it might be written in the notes or something like that. So yes, it's not that the clinician has missed it. It's just that it's not pulled out into the structured data. And the other thing you need to think about is we have a lot of coders and housing staff that go through these notes to pull out this information. And so, you know, they might pull out the most important information related to a specific visit, and that heart attack symptom might be something that happened maybe outside the system, maybe somewhere else where it just wasn't pulled into the structured data. So in this work, we're really saying, you know, you really need to develop the tools and technology to look into that unstructured data. This is NLP, this is AI, these are different types of very advanced methodologies to be able to understand the text and extract that information.
Well, you said that you literally said the next thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know you've written about the impact of AI in medicine and in these kinds of studies. So tell me, AI is clearly a powerful tool, but what are your impressions of the promise of this technology for the kind of work that you do? Is it all positive, or do we need to be careful?
That's exactly it. It is very positive for us. I think there's so many things we can do with AI, but we have to use it very carefully. We have to use it very diligently. And let me give you a good example. So with COVID-19 back in, April, May of 2020, we were at a place in the healthcare system where we needed help to understand which patients were going to progress, which patients we're going to treat, which patients are going to get ventilators. And so we used AI in a lot of cases to really help guide those clinical decisions. The problem was we rushed to get those AI tools developed. A lot of them were not validated. A lot of them were not externally validated. And so what happened is we had some products and some tools coming out into the community that actually were retracted a few months after, just wow. because they were very poorly designed. And these were by very prominent journals. They were poorly designed, they weren't validated, and nobody could replicate what they've shown. So AI is a great tool, but we have to use it very wisely.
But in that case, was the idea that you would figure out who would benefit the most from ventilator therapy and who yes. might do okay without it. But if it's not doing a good job, that literally could be a life and death mistake.
So you can see the need for AI. We really needed the technology to help us understand who to treat and who might not survive the treatment, but it has to be very thoughtfully done. And thoughtfully done means we need to really understand the data used. So AI learns from the data, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to understand what data are we giving the algorithm to learn from, right? Is it, you know, a handful of patients who are very wealthy, no comorbidities, et cetera? Or is it a good representation of all the people that the AI is going to be applied to?
So, and that leads into the final couple of minutes. I wanted to ask, because you've also had a presence in teaching about and running workshops in the issues of trust in this high-tech environment of healthcare. And so tell me, like, where did that come from? Where does trust raise itself in your research? And then what is the approach? What are the lessons learned about how to make sure that we don't outpace our patients and in the process lose all of the alliance with them? And, you know, we're in this together and we're trying to make you better.
Yeah. So trust, Kate, has come up a lot in our work, and we've really been forging forward on this topic. I think it's really important. And we see trust coming into play when we're actually developing tools and we want to provide them to the clinicians. There's that clinician AI trust, but also when we're trying to recruit patients to trials, you know, there's that trust issue there. So I really think that as a data scientist, such as myself, it's really up to us to build the trust between the clinician and the patient and use data and technology to build that trust, right? And so what does that mean? That means that we have both the patient and the clinician involved when we're designing these products. It means that we understand the data we're using to learn from. I think that transparency is a key to building that trust. And being thoughtful about where we take these tools and apply them. It can't just be a tool that's developed at one institute. It has to be applied broadly across institutes.
Thank you for listening to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.
This has been The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio.
If you missed any of it, listen on demand,
online, or with the SiriusXM app.